Good morning. For the news from the various theaters of war, we are at this time to hear from our reporters in Europe, the Southwest Pacific, and from our own nation's capital at Washington, D.C. First, from the western shores of these United States, we take you 8,000 miles into the Southwest Pacific. Go ahead, Australia.
This is Martin Agronsky calling from Allied headquarters in Australia. It's been unofficially estimated that Japs have been losing between 3 and 4 planes to our one since the start of the two-way air blitz over New Guinea last week. Despite these heavy Jap losses, the size of the Jap bombing forces against continues to increase. Equally, the aerial front covered by the Jap bombers in this area continues to widen and deepen. In the past week, the Japs' bombing operations embraced a 1,000-mile-wide front. Its western extremity was the Horn Islands off the northeast land tip of Australia. Its eastern extremity was the Allied base of Tulagi in the Solomon Islands. Further, while the Japs have yet to bomb any important Allied base south of Darwin on the Australian mainland, two Jap machines appeared over Townsville on the east coast, 1,200 miles south of Australia's northern Land's End. To sum up, the effective area in which the Japs have proved they are potentially able to carry out aerial operations against our northern bases is some 1,000 miles in width, some 1,500 miles in depth. When you consider the size of this battlefront and the vast expanse of water it covers, you can appreciate why the Battle of the Southwest Pacific must revolve around aerial power. Watching developments here on the spot, I'm beginning to have confidence in our ability to defend Australia itself. But nowhere, either here or in Malaya or in Java or in Burma, have the Allied nations struck deep into the Jap strength. Responsible observers are convinced that the Jap first-line aerial strength has yet to be seriously damaged. The Jap front-line naval strength has only been scratched, not seriously wounded. But the Jap front-line infantry strength has still powerful and untouched reserves. Without revealing information of value to the enemy, I can tell you what you probably already realize, that the Jap strength, man for man, ship for ship, plane for plane, war machine for war machine, exceeds our own. To sum it up, they've at the moment got mass superiority. What is not enough realized, however, is that we've got quality superiority. I spent a lot of time since arriving here in the first days that the Allied war machine was building up and talking to pilots who had been in combat with the Japs in this area, and then in talking with the men at Air Force headquarters, whose benefit is to study the results of the pilots and the air crew's activity. I've never met a pilot, I've never met an Air Force headquarters officer who was not unshakably convinced of both the superiority of our men and of our machines over the Jets. The one argument you hear at the front and at the operational base is that while the Jets have numbers, we've got quality. I'm convinced from these conversations that the United States can build the best bombing and the best fighting machines in the world, turn out the best men to fly them. After all, excellent machines are America's predominant genius. Every sign seems to indicate the Japs may soon launch an offensive in this vast Pacific area at the island bases, which are first our supply lifeline with America, and second, the striking basis from which alone we can take the offensive against Japan. If the Japs can take those bases, we can still beat them eventually, but nobody here likes even to guess how long that eventually may take. The needs of other war theaters are not forgotten here. But what every pilot who fights for you out here wants you to know is that the quality of our plane, even fighting against 4 or 5 to 1 superiority, will enable them to stop the expected Jap offensive dead in its tracks. That's if they can get your quality machines in any reasonable numbers. It's felt here that quality is our one superiority and that a superhuman effort could be made to take advantage of it. If the Japs take those Pacific Island bases, talk of an offensive by General MacArthur's command will become just a pleasant way of making conversation. This is Martin Agronsky returning now to San Francisco.
And now across the continent to our newsroom in New York.
For our next on-the-spot report, we take you now to London, England.
This is London. John McVane speaking. The latest official report today on the landing of British troops in the Vichy-controlled island of Madagascar says the British troops landed at Courier Bay, covered by naval aircraft, with the intention of proceeding across the isthmus to the naval base of Diego Suarez. Commando troops formed part of the landing party. The British forces met little opposition. Courier Bay is about 10 miles west of the naval base. It's understood that there aren't any Americans, Free French, or South Africans in the force. Official British circles emphasize that the Madagascar development is essentially strategic rather than political. It's said to be evident that no political barrier stood in the way of a Japanese occupation of the island. Even before Laval came to power, it's pointed out, Vichy was unwilling to take any steps to prevent outlying bases from being used by the Axis. The lesson of Indochina and Syria was mentioned, and it was said to be folly to imagine that Vichy would lift a finger to stop the Japanese from taking over the island. Such an occupation would have had grave naval consequences for the United Nations, and an official spokesman today stressed the presence of the Japanese admirals in Vichy and the handsome entertainment they received as probably marking further concessions by Vichy to the Axis, especially to Japan. The landing on Madagascar gets all the headlines in the London afternoon papers. The British are pleased that the United Nations have forestalled the Axis in this important communications base. It's being pointed out, too, that Vichy promised that no Japanese infiltration would be allowed into Indochina, and that Germany wouldn't be allowed to get a foothold in Syria. The Axis-dominated Vichy government twice failed to live up to its word, and today's London Evening Standard says, both in Washington and London, it's now accepted that Vichy's word is as bad as her bond. Neither can be trusted. Presumably the same logic applies in other parts of the world as in Madagascar. It's being emphasized here that the United Nations must deal with the people of France, not the Vichy government. The French National Committee hasn't issued any statement on the occupation. General de Gaulle has a strong following in the island, which is reported to have succeeded in establishing a secret radio station and scattering free French propaganda. The French National Committee represents the people of France among the United Nations, and it's taken for granted in French circles in London that the National Committee will organize an administration of the island from among the officials and civilians of Madagascar who believe in a relentless battle against the Axis is the only way of freeing France. De Gaulle is the symbol of France's fight against the Axis, and news that Madagascar has joined the other free French colonies should be a powerful inspiration to the French people who are carrying on the underground fight inside France. A strong force of British bombers last night went to southern Germany. They bombed the industrial city of Stuttgart and the Skoda works in Pilsen, Czechoslovakia. The docks at Nantes were also raided, and British fighters attacked airfields in France. German planes last night bombed towns on the south coast of England. Four were destroyed. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
News from Northern Europe is reported next from Stockholm, Sweden.
Hello, New York. This is David Anderson speaking from Stockholm. While Admirals Nomura and Abe were conferring with Laval, Darlan, and other Vichy heads, the British announced this morning that British military and naval forces have landed on the coast of Madagascar to begin the occupation of the island. This news brings to an end the discussion of the potential threat of Madagascar as a Japanese naval base for attacks on Allied shipping in the Atlantic and Indian Oceans. Last March 11th, I broadcast a Berlin report from here to the effect that an agreement had already been reached between Vichy and Tokyo over the disposition of Madagascar as a Japanese base. And although Vichy denials to all of these stories were heard, the meetings which have just been taking place in Vichy between the two Japanese admirals, Laval and Darlan, seems to indicate that there was some truth in them. Particularly significant in this connection is what was stated in the Vichy press conference yesterday in answer to a question as to the importance of the Vichy-Japanese talks. It was said, and I quote, "These meetings are more than a courtesy call," unquote. And then the Vichy spokesman went on to stress the present friendly relations existing between Vichy and Japan. This statement, then, combined with past experience in French Indochina, leaves little more to be desired from the standpoint of justification for the latest British move. In connection with a present interest in Vichy, I would like to include an unconfirmed rumor circulating in Stockholm to the effect that Laval was present at the Salzburg meeting with Hitler and Mussolini. The rumor states that Laval's intention was to establish a basis for a peace with the Axis. According to the rumor, the hitch occurred when Mussolini called for relinquishing of Nice as the only basis on which the Italians could negotiate. At this point, Laval considered his mission completed since he had no intention of giving up Nice, whereupon he returned to Vichy. I repeat once more that this is an unconfirmed rumor, but one which is highly plausible. This is David Anderson returning you now to New York.
And now to our own capital for the report of Earl Godwin in the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. The registration for sugar ration books was about 90% successful here on its first day. A little more successful than that in our neighboring city of Baltimore, I think. The crush of housewives swamped some of the schools where voluntary workers did not appear. But from the way things look, we will have plenty of experience with rationing ere this war is over, and we'll know how to line up for it. We may learn something today about gasoline rationing, due May 15, and also about restrictions on railroad and bus travel, or taxicab travel, rather, following the president's designation yesterday of Joe Eastman, transportation director, to take on all the problems of rubber tire travel for any and all purposes, including the fast-disappearing joyride, but more seriously, bus, private travel, and taxicab use. And the sweeping order has taken steel and iron away from manufacturers of practically all the gadgets that were left for modern American life. In 90 days' time, and the only substitute metal is gold and silver. This puts iron and steel into the war 100% and makes it easy for the big manufacturers who have plenty of steel to make things with and have the big orders. But there are plenty of friends of the second string and smaller industries who are nervous lest this tremendous channeling of industry, big industry, to war will wreck business, cause a violent depression, and create post-war unemployment of a great extent. The Treasury suggests a plan whereby a cushion of the taxes paid now might be utilized to be given back to industry after the war. But now what's needed for small business is something like Senator Mead of New York provided for in his small business bill, which passed the Senate and awaits House action. That is, a guide, counselor, and friend in Washington to get war orders for small industries, and also a quick and undoubted method of financing them. Private banks, once the friend of small local business, don't seem to rise to the opportunity. You know, the House of Representatives has a special small business committee headed by Representative Patman of Texas, a kind and far-seeing gentleman, who said last night that the small business manufacturer comprises 50% of the nation's potentiality and can and must be turned to full account. Wright Patman, with many others, sees a great danger in too much buildup for the big industries and starvation for the small business, and I'll quote him for a few lines. The small business men and women of America are essential to our democratic way of life. They are necessary to our social order. They bulwark the great institutions around which all civilization is built, the home, the church, and the school. They are the most effective enemy of those four greatest evils, poverty, ignorance, disease, and crime. And therefore, when Wright Patman, and most of the members of Congress that are working with him go in for helping small business and small industry, they are helping their friends and neighbors and the kind of folks that you and I are and who make American business what it is and what make America what it is. Those quickie commissions in the Army or Navy, men from civil life, commissioned in uniform, put at the desk. Army and Navy wants him to relieve regular officers of desk work so that these trained officers can take the field, although there is plenty of opposition to that sort of thing in Washington today, and that's all from Washington at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Godwin. The news from our own capital, ladies and gentlemen, ends this regular early morning roundup of events all over the world. Your reporters were Martin Agronsky from Australia, John McVane from London, David Anderson speaking from Stockholm, and Earl Godwin from Washington. For the latest news, we suggest that you keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.